Investors Chronicle.
Companies and Markets Podcast, Thursday the 16th of February, 2023. Dan Jones off sick today, so hosting Alex Newman. He's been drafted in late. The coup starts now. Are you right, Alex?
It's not a coup. I mean, I've not poisoned Dan or anything. I think he's just off. I'm all good, thanks.
I think he had the deli belly, didn't he, or something? So.
He did go to Rye last weekend.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Are they somehow linked?
To Delhi.
Is that somehow Yes. Rye, one of the sank ports.
Well, thank you for that, Mark.
I'd actually like to point out to our listeners...
It's also the former home of Spike Milligan.
I'm only here in a supervisory capacity today.
Not even been introduced yet, Mark.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, please, John.
No, it's as you will have heard... Julian Hoffman and Mark Robinson are down the line, as usual, and champing at the bit today. But before we let them loose, I'm just going to do a quick roundup of the week's news as normal. So another week, another gas company pulling in bumper profits. This week it's the turn of British gas owner Centrica, who pulled in a threefold rise in operating profit for 2022. The £3.3 billion figure was driven by North Sea gas production, nuclear power and energy trading divisions, and benefited from the volatile wholesale markets after Russia invaded Ukraine. The number of pubs and bars which went bankrupt last year was the highest in a decade. 512 companies went bust, an 83% increase. The sector struggled with elevated energy bills and higher labour, food and drink costs. Trading platform Plus500's full-year profits grew to nearly $500 million as it appeared to have retained pandemic period punters. Nearly 90% of the trading platform's sales on over-the-counter products came from those who had been with the company for more than a year. Car maker Ford is to cut 3,800 jobs across Europe, including 1,300 in the UK. The company said it was taking action to align roles, quote, with a similar, more focused and increasingly electric product portfolio. Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway cut back on its bet on TSMC. Having only held the position for one quarter, it acquired a $4.1 billion stake in the Taiwanese semiconductor manufacturer, but it revealed in its recent results that it has now sold 87% of those shares. And finally, plane maker Airbus reported a flat operating profit of £4.7 million despite increasing sales by 13%. Its CEO blamed an, quote, adverse operating environment that prevented our supply chain from recovering at the pace we expected. Back to, I nearly said over to Dan. So muscle memory, but over to Alex.
Thanks, John.
For the rest of the show.
Lovely. Okay, so today we're going to talk about banks, given it's we're sort of in banking season, results time. Going to touch on the FTSE 100's new all-time high and finish with a little bit of a chat about Glencore. So just to start with the banks, and we're also going to talk about a brokerage whose main source of profits sort of makes it look increasingly bank-like. I mean, this should be a kind of boom time for credit providers, you'd think, given that interest rates are rising. But I mean, when it comes to results, there's always a surprise in store. Julian, you covered the Barclays results this week. What were the highlights, lowlights, and other assorted lights in those results today?
Yeah, thank you, Alex. Barclays Bank, our favourite piece of rhyming slang. The problem with Barclays is the split between the investment bank and the deposit bank. So and this has been a theme going back, I guess, as long as either of us have been writing about them. But essentially, the last quarter in particular was pretty bad for the investment bank. Nobody is doing any deals. The trading side didn't sort of step up and save them either. Particularly fixed income, for some reason, the traders missed all their targets for fixed income trading. And the net result of that was the market looked for any excuse to mark down the shares. and they reacted pretty badly. So it was, at one point it was down 9%, but I think they managed to pare back the sort of daily loss to about 7.5%. And it's curious really why everyone takes aim at this every time there's a results season. Is Barclays trying to be the all-enveloping hybrid investment bank that it wants to be, or is it just an awkwardly put together company where one bit is kind of underperforming at one time when one bit is outperforming, the other part of the bank seems to be underperforming. They never seem to be able to yoke it together and move in a step in one direction. And it's a constant, it's been a constant debate about whether they shouldn't just break it up and or scale down the investment bank to just a simple sort of commercial lending operation. But the main theme I got out of this is that I don't think people, and this is just my opinion, I would say, but I'm not sure that people trust the current management, or at least rate the current management to get them, into a place that's more sustainable. They lost a lot of goodwill over the fact that one of their divisions in the States managed to overissue so many securities, and that resulted in a huge regulatory fine. That's another 1.8 billion of fine this year. And in fact, someone totted up the number of fines they've had over the last decade or so, and it's something like 18 billion pounds worth of regulatory fines that Barclays has paid out. I mean, if you can imagine that money had gone to the shareholders.
Yeah. So that is the one constant, isn't it? I suppose that there are, whether the investment bank's going to be underperforming or the retail bank's going to be performing, they're still going to be shelling out for fines or other sort of credit provisions or things that, it's very hard for investors to see on the surface, but are going to go wrong anyway.
It is just true. I know. It is a black, when we've described it before as a black box operation. I think that analogy is more true now than at any time in its recent history. The compensation, of course, is that they can get people on side by essentially paying out more capital and improving the returns to shareholders. But even in these results, that sort of disappointed. I mean, everybody was pointing to the fact that the other similar kind of commercial hybrid banks in the Europe are actually on an upward swing when it comes to shareholder returns, and Barclays seems to be kind of frozen on a level. So they're not doing well comparatively to their competitors when it comes to that measure. And I don't know what the answer to this is, whether whether they'll improve. I mean, if they just improve what they're paying out, whether people will be more sanguine about the situation and improve, and say, well, here's the compensation, you just have to put up with the quirks of this rather strange hybrid institution.
So we also had results from Standard Chartered today. I mean, they don't have the sort of retail banking fallback that Barclays does, but momentum there's seems to be a lot stronger. They announced a share buyback today despite weaker than expected profits. What's the story and bullishness behind Standard Charter shares at the moment?
Yeah, the share price has done really well. As I'm sure you've noticed, it's good. It's up a good sort of 40%, I think, since the summer. The story here really is that the interest rates are coming to Standard Charter's rescue. So their core income from much of their balance sheet is improving rapidly. They seem to be quite sensitive to emerging market rates, which are now going up. It's primarily an emerging market bank. They weren't without issues. It's fair to say they have quite a big presence in wealth management, which seems to be the cornerstone of a lot of their profit. And what was interesting from the results was that investors will react, and as soon as we had all that volatility last year, everybody pulled their funds and stuck it into US Treasuries or bonds or something, And that caused like a 17% fall in revenue for that particular division. And when you consider that's like more than half of their total profit comes from wealth management, that actually took a decent hit. And they actually made up for it by the fact that interest margin is improving exponentially, and other parts of the business delivered the income. So it was like two steps forward, one step back, really. I think that was my take on the results for them. Yeah. And also the share buyback was a little weaker than profits that people had forecast, but there had also been takeover rumors in the run-up to this. So it might be an interesting takeover for someone, but we'll have to see whether that comes down the line or not.
Yeah, so this is the takeover in question is First Abu Dhabi was reported about a month ago to have sort of run a due diligence process on potentially acquiring or merging with Standard Chartered. Looks like they've backed away, but there's still a fair bit of chatter in the financial media that once the 6-month walkaway period ends, they're going to be back to the table. What's your hot take, Julian? Do you think this is likely? Are your contacts in Abu Dhabi talking much?
Oh, my contact in Abu Dhabi is mainly Michael Fay, who lived in Abu Dhabi at one point. The problem I see with that is, A, if they come back in 6 months, they're going to have to pay quite a lot more for the company than they did at the beginning of that process, because the share price is going up. But on the other hand, it's clear that the business has got some value left in it. A lot of people were speculating whether Charter would just simply vanish or be broken up. That somebody would take the wealth management and somebody else would cherry pick the banking. But I think the lesson of this year is that there is actually a business model there that can weather different different conditions in the market, whereas Barclays doesn't seem to be able to do that. So I mean, it could be an interesting acquisition for someone, I think, who wants that footprint but also needs a business model which is a bit more diversified and resilient.
Yeah. Okay, just to round out our banks chat, tomorrow we've got NatWest results. So I'm conscious that listeners might be armed with more information by the time they hear this conversation than we are currently. But Julian, can you sketch out what's been happening with the lender formerly known as RBS to us and what investors might be expecting this year?
Yes, NatWest. So I think it's formally, it's now formally NatWest, isn't it? I don't think RBS exists anymore except in Scotland. So the results, as you say, are coming out on Friday this week. Everyone's looking to see whether the costs are going to rise for them next year. NatWest has been quite ruthless quite heavy on the cost cutting over the last 5 years. They've managed to cut out about a quarter of their fixed costs, mainly from closing branches in various parts of the country. If you live down here where I do, the nearest NatWest branch is now 20 miles away. The question is whether they can keep doing that now, or they will just see they'll just be able to plateau on that, and all of their income increases now are going to come from the margin they earn on deposits and loans, which I think is probably more likely now. I don't think there's much fat left to cut in NatWest. It's been quite a it's been a well-run business, I would say, the last couple of years. I mean, the CEO has done a reasonable job, and they're the most geared to higher interest rates of all the UK banks, so they should be doing really well, and I think we'll see that in the results tomorrow. But the outlook for 2023 is what's key, and whether that margin is going to sort of plateau a bit because they can't find enough costs to cut. I think that might be the where they get marked down. They're also doing things like buying up fintechs. A few days ago they did a sort of 125 million acquisition of a fintech. So it's an interesting to see where they're going to head with that side of the business, whether that becomes a strategy point to look for as well.
Yeah. So I mean, and a decent shake-up and favourable trade winds mean that reportedly Dame Alison Rose, the CEO, is expected to get a bonus of up to £1 million, which is the first time a bonus has been handed to a NatWest or formerly RBS CEO since the 2008 bailout. She's also recently been in the hot seat a little bit about interest rates and the degree to which NatWest are passing higher rates on to savers and depositors. I checked their main flexible saver account today, and it's something like 0.65% up to 25,000 and then 1.5% thereafter. So, I mean, it's certainly not market leading when it comes to flexible saver accounts, though their fixed term products are a little more competitive. Are they, do you think, Julian, they're sort of resting a little too easily on these laurels, or is it just a feature of high street banks that they don't need to get into this, this sort of dogfight on the higher savings rates because people, a lot of their depositors aren't necessarily thinking about savings rates. It's just one of the go-to accounts to put your...
I think most of their depositors will be thinking about paying the gas bill, which might sort of militate against that. But I think what the trend you'll see, I think, is, and Barclays and Standard Chartered reported it this week, is that they're seeing deposit churn. So, I mean, it's not huge, but it's a good sort of 4 or 5 percentage points of the total book is people basically pulling funds and looking for better rates. And it might be a trend that NatWest needs to watch out for, because if people just decide that, well, if we're not getting the rate we want, we'll just go and find someone else to give us a better rate, that could prove to be a problem. So I don't think they can afford to be too complacent about it. Because it's a competitive market up there, and as we know, there are lots of other capital hungry businesses that are prepared to offer better returns for your deposit. So I think that'll be a touchstone tomorrow to see whether they're going to address any issues around deposit churn and whether they might improve their savings rates. I mean, it's also for them, of course, it's a political issue, because the government still owns under 50% of the business. So as soon as anything comes up that's just mildly controversial, they get criticised in the House of Parliament.
Indeed. Well, I mean, speaking of cash just sort of sitting in accounts, maybe we could sort of turn to Hargreaves Lansdown, whose half years were out this week as well. I mean, their revenues on cash really was a sort of standout figure. It has happened a couple of times before, but this period was notable that for the net interest earned on cash held in investment accounts. So these are Hargreaves customers who are maybe reducing their exposure to funds and shares, but they're still leaving sizable chunks of cash in their accounts on the platform. Revenues from this cash, which jumped from 11 million in the year prior to nearly 122 million pounds in this half, and that's against turnover of 350 million pounds for the period and profits of nearly 200 million, implying that more than half of earnings are from this fairly cheap trick, in a way. Mark, is your sense that they've sort of become overly reliant on this weird aspect of their customer trading patterns?
Well, I tend to think it might just be a temporary function of the market itself, because as we were talking in editorial meeting earlier on this morning, is that trading volumes have dipped alarmingly from the first quarter of last year. And so where you haven't got that churn, their standard ways to generate earnings has been effectively taken away. And I would think, not under normal circumstances, this is seen as something of like ancillary income, really. And they've come under fire in the past as well for their treatment of customer funds in this regard, by contrast to someone like AJ Bell, for instance. But it doesn't seem to me that it's a central part of the business itself, even though the contribution is has been disproportionately large because of the general softening in equity markets.
Yeah, a very nice diplomatic answer. I think, I mean, these results, I suppose it should be said, you know, they also covered, which is kind of what the point you're getting at there, Mark, so they also covered a historically bad period for consumer and investor confidence. So, you know, we could maybe conversely assume that if markets do gather some steam, that trading is going to pick up, and the normalization of retail investor activity might push profits higher.
It also corresponded with a period of rising interest rates as well, which is obviously beneficial in that regard. But I do tend to think if I was management there, I wouldn't look upon this as center of the business. It's part of a holding operation, I think, until those trading volumes pick up, hopefully towards the latter part of this year.
I mean, a lot of people went into cash, didn't they? I mean, if you look at the stats, and I mean, everyone does it in the quarter that actually you should be buying stuff. So, you know, it's just one of those weird behavioral investor things that they kind of Hargreaves Lansdown has also benefited from in a kind of indirect way. But I mean, the most entertaining thing about the results is how quickly Peter Hargreaves goes around and criticizes the current management. I mean, that's the more salient feature of it, really.
I mean, and just to bring listeners up to speed on that point, his big criticism at the moment is with this kind of wealth management technology push, which he's saying is a little bit too cost intensive. I mean, Hargreaves Lansdown occupies this interesting position, doesn't it? It's sort of the leading investment platform, but also one of the more expensive ones, partly because it's so well established and trusted. Is this kind of technology push the best way to preserve this edge? You know, because I mean, they're going to lose out if they enter a price war, presumably, from their current levels. Is that a sensible thing to do?
I think they have to try it. I think the problem they've got is that they've reached, as you say, such a size that growth rates are difficult to imagine. And the only way that they could do that is either by cutting the cost of the business back to the bone and substituting it with another technology that can do that, which is perhaps what we're talking about here in terms of this automated investment device. On the other hand, it's not a proven way of running the business yet. As someone on Twitter pointed out, if everybody just chose artificial chatbots to give you investment advice, they'd probably just recommend buying tracker funds for everything, a bit like Cristillo used to do, actually. But it's a business that it has so much scale, it can't grow very quickly, or at least, and B, it needs to find a way to protect its very high margins. And as technology makes it easier for other people to choose different types of investors, different type of investments, different types of platforms, this AI approach might be the only one that makes any sense for Hargreaves Lansdown. But I mean, it's still, I think, very early days. I mean, not entirely convinced I would go to chat GTP to ask for investment advice. Although I did ask them for a Marxist restaurant review once, and it just came back with a restaurant review, and at the end it said hail the proletariat. So that was its take on a Marxist restaurant review.
Yeah. Well, I do like the idea of a Cristillo generative AI chatbot as well. Moving on into the sort of post-Cristillo IC world, we probably can't finish this podcast without mentioning the FTSE 100. Guys, we need to talk about it. It hit 8,000 points this week. Is this important?
Apparently, it's psychologically important, but I remember them saying that about when it breached the 7,000 point mark as well. And I suggest when we get to 9,000 points, it'll be much the same. This to me is only interesting in line with what I was mentioning before about the fact that we've had falling volumes. And as Julia mentioned, a great deal more investors just going into cash at this stage of the cycle as well. But if I was looking at this, if I was looking at this and I didn't have any idea about the levers behind stock market performance, you would look at it and you'd be quite bemused, really, because you look at the economy itself. The outlook is still fairly poor at the moment. Inflation is still near a 40-year high, and we're all a bit poorer because real wages have been in retreat for the last year or so. But what I think it's interesting is that we've had the index itself has increased by about 6.5% from the start of this year after kind of flatlining through much of last year. Everyone knows the reasons why the market, the UK benchmark outperformed its peers in the G7 is because of the weightings ascribed to energy, mining and large finance companies within the index itself. So it was no surprise that it did outperform. But it wasn't an extravagant performance either. It ended flatlining throughout the year. So I think this uptick in the early part of 2023 may be significant in that it might signal that investors are anticipating that the Bank of England may actually cease its interest rate cycle rises a bit earlier than expected and might even pivot towards decreases by the end of the year. I mean, that's purely speculation at the moment, but certainly if you'd have asked someone 5 or 6 months ago, they'd have probably been a bit skeptical about that viewpoint, but things don't seem quite as grim as they once did. So in this morning's email, I characterize it as that what it could just represent is the end of the beginning.
Yeah. I suppose the other point, other feature of the FTSE 100 to mention is that something like 4/5 of its revenues come from outside the UK. So it's not so much reflective of the UK economy, more really, you know, a kind of sterling weakness against other major currencies.
Well, yes, I mean, it's a disgraceful legacy of our colonial past, isn't it? Let's face it.
Another one.
Yeah, exactly. All these companies earning their money abroad. I agree with Mark on that, but I mean, the volume, the point to make, actually, this is a technical point on trading, is that the volumes have been so low in terms of pushing the index higher. You do wonder about the strength of that rally. There was a similar situation back in 2010, and then we had a subsequent fall that was quite painful. I don't know. It's a very traditionalist composition of companies. They don't earn their money, particularly in the UK. And as the government keeps complaining, we don't have any tech on it. So, you know, take your choice on this, but you know, if you've got an index tracker that's tracking the FTSE 100, you've done pretty well out of it, really, the last 18 months.
Yeah, I think with dollar strength as well, that's going to boost your total return in the FTSE as well. And the dollar remains very strong at this point. The point you made, Julian, is germane as well, because the less participants you have in any market, the less price discovery you have. So, you know, perhaps we should take these recent rises, and in fact the fact that it was sustained through last year with a pinch of salt, really.
Yeah, just on the point on performance, I mean, you know, the other thing that a new record all-time high for the FTSE 100 just seemed to bring about is lots of commentary talking about how, oh, you know, it's only up 15% this century, but compared to something like 218% from the S&P 500. This neglects, of course, the fact that if you factor in dividends, FTSE 100 is up almost 200% on a total return basis.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, which is 5% a year compounding. It's not amazing. It's not horrible. But, you know, given we've had the financial crisis in that time, the commodities crash and the pandemic, it could maybe be worse. Maybe the bigger question is which equity index seems like a smarter bet for the next 23 years, the resource rich FTSE 100, or the, you know, as mentioned, the tech heavy S&P. Thoughts?
A blended approach. That's what we normally say.
just sit on the fence.
Chatbot Mark Robinson springs into action. Yeah.
Hail the proletariat. I mean, that's an impossible question to answer, Alex, in fairness, because you can't. You know, the tech boom in the States could easily shift to another market, couldn't it? So, whether what we're seeing now is just pricing in future maturity is a moot point, isn't it? You could just say that all these companies that have done really well and have propelled that index to new heights, in 10 years, 15 years' time, they're all going to be as boring as I don't know, a big insurer or something like that.
Well, so, the point is as well, it was a relatively small number of companies as well that was driving that growth in the tech sector in the States. So, you know, as you say, I mean, there's going to be a lot of companies that will fall by the wayside, lots of technologies that fall by the wayside and be superseded. We really haven't answered or even addressed this question, I don't think.
I suppose the root of it is, you know, the association with US economy and US stock market with higher levels of innovation, risk taking, etc., versus the I suppose, you know, we maybe have unfairly characterized it as old world economy of the FTSE 100, given that it's still, you know, a very active part of the primary economy, and that matters, as we're going to touch on in our last feature. But yeah, I mean, it's probably also an unfair question, so you don't have to answer it.
Well, I didn't.
Brilliant. Okay, let's move on then. So finally, we also need to talk about Glencore, not least because, to circle back to a previous talking point, I believe Hargreaves Lansdown recently said it was the most heavily traded stock on its platform recently, supplanting the ever magnetic Lloyds banking group. They had numbers out this week too. Profits hit a record mark. What were the big drivers of this landmark year?
King coal, by all accounts, that was it, and their trading activities as well. I covered an update in probably about 2 or 3 weeks ago now, and at that stage we didn't know, you know, how they'd fared through those through their trading activities. But given the level of volatility that we've had in commodity prices over the last 12, 18 months, it was always likely to be positive as well. Thermal coal, coal prices have been favorable, or they've softened just a little bit recently. You know, they have dropped recently due to the mild European winter, but I also learned that the first shipments coming out of Australia going to China have just started as well, which would be generally favorable for prices in that market going forward. It just shows though that it doesn't pay to make too many assumptions in the commodities complex, because again, if you'd have asked people a few years ago the outlook for coal prices in 2023, and it would be far more downcast than the reality suggests.
Yeah, I mean, just to stay with the coal point, I suppose that there's a lot of investors out there, and I imagine a lot of listeners, for whom the prospect of investing in one of the world's largest coal miners doesn't sit right, given, you know, growing concerns about the climate crisis. I mean, Glencore says, they said this week that their climate action transition plan has broadly been supported. And they refer to stakeholders rather than shareholders, implying, you know, that they're thinking also about customers and producer countries, which we can't rule out of the equation here. It's not just about shareholder purity, I suppose. What's your general take on what they've, you know, they're called their responsible coal depletion strategy? Is it the wise one, looking back at the last few years of divestments by peers and sort of bets against coal, which have not really been proven, as you mentioned?
Well, part of the reason for that as well is because so many mining companies have failed to put in the requisite investment. So a little bit similar to crude oil in that regard, you're going to get a sticking point in the market when demand increases and there's no new supply coming on as well. I guess one thing that they're looking at as well, or at least all the steel makers are looking at as well, a way to transition away from coal. But I'm not even quite sure the science of that. What is this called, green steel? Is that the term?
I believe it might be, yeah. Getting there probably requires some technologies which aren't fully realised, is my understanding. Yeah.
And I mean, you've seen this year as well that Germany has had to refire coal plants. We have here from time to time. Repurpose their old input material. So I don't know. I'm always a little bit cynical about the way that we're going in in picking out arbitrary targets for carbon reductions. I think we should be pay a little bit more attention to the market itself, because it could be extremely destabilizing in terms of prices as we go forward. We're definitely going to see this with crude oil. You could argue that we're seeing it already. If you suddenly take a supply out of a market, or the incentive to replace supply, then you're going to be in problems because demand, because of the growth of sort of middle classes in the emerging market economies, that's still going on. There doesn't seem to be any halt there in terms of demand. So I'm as Julia, if I might to paraphrase Julia from earlier on, I'm a sort of disgraceful relic from our colonial era. So I just think that we need to have a little bit more joined up thinking on this transition.
Yeah, and in the process, you did answer my question earlier. So it's going to be the FTSE 100 which will ride higher over the S&P over the next 23 years. So
there you go.
Yeah. Lovely. Okay, let's wrap things up there, shall we? So this week's cover story, written by Val Cipriani, asks, is buy-to-let investing worth it anymore? And that's available in all good news agents and, of course, online at investorschronicle.co.uk. Thanks to Mark, Julian and to John for your help today, and to all of you for listening. Thank you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.